Just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Management. My name is Mike Mayo. We are powered by the Opus 111 Group, and we are your antidote to conventional wisdom. We're going to give you straightforward talk about the world of finance, the markets, and economic insights, and also some analysis and what we hope is valuable advice that can give you some basis for making some sound investment decisions, even when you're feeling a little uncertain. So, welcome to Money Management. This past week was really, there wasn't really that much to it, quite frankly, in terms of the markets and developments, though we will talk a little bit about what the Fed said that kind of got things excited on Thursday, and the economic developments that we've seen, and just market overviews that, again, we hope will provide you some good insight. But before we get too far along, let me tell you where we closed yesterday. The Dow rallied back from Thursday selling. It ended at 34,283, higher by 391 points. S&P higher at 44.15, the NASDAQ up at 13,798, Russell 2000 at 1706, gold lower at $1,939 an ounce, silver also lower at $22.21 an ounce, crude about unchanged at $76.46 a barrel. The 10-year ticked up a little bit from yesterday, but down from where it was on Thursday. It's at 4.61%. And soft white wheat was quoted at $6.90 a bushel. So that's where we ended. Now, what I want to do before I get too far into our regular programming is that, as you may know, hopefully, today is Veterans Day. And yesterday, because we get to double dip, it was the Marine Corps birthday. 248 years of the finest fighting force the world has ever known. And I want to take a few minutes and talk about those issues, if you don't mind. Bear with me. I hope you'll find it, I just feel as if I am honor-bound to do this. So, originally it was called, Veterans Day was called Armistice Day, and it was to celebrate the end of World War I. World War I ended at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. And President Eisenhower renamed it in 1958 to commemorate everyone who has served, regardless of whether they served during wartime, which I think is fair. And so that is the genesis of Veterans Day. So happy Veterans Day to all you folks who have served. And now I got to segue into my my club ad here. And thinking about it over all these years, I believe I had four main reasons for joining the Marine Corps. One, I didn't really know what it meant, but I knew I wanted to be a Marine. I read a book about the story of the U.S. Marines when I was 10, and that was the name of that song. Two, I determined that this war, the Vietnam War, that is, you may have read about it, was going to be the defining moment of my generation. I didn't want to be a spectator. Three, I never wanted to look back and say, what if? What if I had joined the Marines? What if this? What if that? And four, for no particular reason, I wanted to see what war was really like. Well, I've always been glad that I did it, and I feel that I did accomplish all four of those goals. I wouldn't trade any of the experiences, comrades, or the memories of that short but important time in my life. And after all these years have passed, I realized that, as with our troops who are deployed now, we're at the end of the pipeline, and as those in the field, the bush, downrange, all means the same thing, as we all quickly learned, we only had each other to depend on. It's not mom and apple pie, it's the folks right next to you. Those are the ones you fight for and depend on. We knew fear and hardship in places that were shunned by most of our generation. And those of us who had danced with the devil and came out on the other side, well, we'll always have that something, the truth inside us, and we recognize it in others, older or younger, who have walked that same path. A couple quotes, one from a Marine chaplain who was in Fallujah in 2004, and I'm quoting, "Marines are a tribe of warriors. They exist to close with and destroy the enemy. They have their tribal mores, rituals, and rites. The enemy has desecrated members of the tribe and taunted the Marines. The enemy has asked for a fight. The Marines are in full pursuit and absolutely determined to annihilate their foe. We are in a violent land with an evil element, and they are having violence visited upon them. There is no room here for half measures, unquote. From Major General at the time, James Mattis, who was 1st Marine Division going into Iraq in 2003. He later became Commandant of the Marine Corps and also Secretary of Defense. He was the one who coined the phrase as in his message to all hands as they were going into Iraq. Demonstrate to the world that there is no better friend, no worse enemy than a U.S. Marine. And finally, from Mr. Reagan, president thereof, he said, some people spend an entire lifetime wondering if they made a difference. The Marines don't have that problem. So, I apologize if that didn't go down well, but I'm sorry that I just had to do it. So, there we are. Now, let's go back to much more mundane pursuits here. This past week, there was a couple of announcements from the feds, one from the IRS, one from Social Security, that is going to affect you. Actually, these are for next year. They raised the tax brackets for 2024 due to the due to inflation. So now the highest brackets have all the brackets have been raised. For example, in taxable income for joint folks, the range goes from 0 to 23,200, and that's 10%. Now, and you can look up the details. You know, just Google 2024 tax brackets. It'll have everything you need to know. I just want to give you a heads up. The standard deduction will also increase next year. It'll go up to 20,002 for married couples, up from 27,700. Single folks may claim 14,600, which is up from 13,850. Now, from the Social Security standpoint, they're raising the wage base limit. In other words, you get to pay Social Security for a whole lot longer, you're going to have to make some serious change to be not paying Social Security. Let's put it that way. For this year, the wage base is $160,200. So you're contributing to Social Security up until you're making that much money. And if you earn more than that, then you don't have to pay any more Social Security that year. Next year, it will be rising. The wage base has gone up an average about $4,000 a year for, most recently. So in any case, the new wage base is going to be 168.6. So if you ask for a raise, it could be helpful because that will mean you pay less Social Security tax. So work on your negotiation skills and see if you can pull that off, okay? In any rate, I want to talk to, now I'm going to get back into the market stuff. As I said, there was a kind of a dearth of news this week. There were no announcements, very few earnings reports, and the traders were all waiting for somebody else to do something. And so that's why Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll see what the Fed's going to do. We don't know. And then Mr. Powell spoke on Thursday, and he was of the opinion that, we haven't, maybe we're not done here yet. Maybe we haven't taken it quite as far as we need to. And while he didn't say, come out and say in, 25 words or less that they are going to raise rates at some point, that was enough to kick the traders into profit-taking mode from the last few days of having gone up, last week and prior. So they just kicked into some profit-taking. It didn't drop all that much, but it was enough to, bring the henny-penny sky is falling folks out from the woodwork again. This is the start of the end. We're all going to die. The usual stuff. Now, this last weekend, the market was, like I said, pretty boring, all in all, and that happens. There's just sometimes when there's not much going on. We'll be looking for these kinds of days here in another few months, I'm thinking. But in any regard, we didn't have much activity. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, there was just very little movement in the indices. But Thursday, this guy Jerome Powell was speaking, and by the way, he's head of the Federal Reserve, in case you were unaware. And he said, when in a news conference, he was talking International Monetary Fund, I believe. But in any case, he was at a news conference, and he said that more work maybe need to be done to bring down inflation. Now, this is even though the slowdown in the pace of inflation has been pretty encouraging for most of these folks. He said, and I'm quoting, the Federal Open Market Committee, that's the part of the Fed that makes the decisions about rates, is committed to achieving a stance of monetary policy that is sufficiently restrictive to bring inflation down to 2% over time. And here's the catchphrase: we are not confident we have achieved such a stance, unquote. That set the traders off. Now, he didn't say anything definitive. He didn't say he was going to raise rates. He didn't say by how much. All he needed was to give some indication to these cats that he was going to maybe someday raise the rates by a little bit. Well, like I said, that ticked off the profit taking on that day, and the yields went up on the treasuries, and that. We had the Dow off a couple hundred points, so it wasn't huge, but it was not a positive feeling, I guess you could say. But then yesterday, the 10-year Treasury. Now again, this is the bogey. This is the we talk about it on the quotes in the morning show, and we talk about the 10-year because what the return, the yield is on the 10-year sets interest rates for lots of stuff, such as home loans, car loans, credit card balances, so on and so on and so on. And so it has a big ripple effect, but not quite as much as what some of these moves might suggest. So Friday, again, the 10-year dropped just about 5 basis points from where it was the day before. Now, it had jumped 10 basis points after Mr. Powell had iterated that the bank was not confident that it has done enough. No, understand that a basis point is 1/100 of a percent. So if think of it as like a dollar, and so 1/100 is a penny. So we're talking about 5 cents, which is 5 basis points, or 10 cents, which is 10 basis points, relatively speaking, which is what caused all this travail. All they're talking. Traders are all they're thinking about is that what's the trend? What could happen next? What might happen next? So they start acting accordingly. Well, apparently they thought they got time off for good behavior today, yesterday, because the when the rates dropped, the market took off, and that's fine. But again, you got to expect this kind of backing and forthing when all these folks are doing is looking at the interest rates. And to be clear, we're not saying that the overall growth in the economy is strong, but with all these weak pockets in the economy hogging all the headlines, kind of over-reporting on the weak spots, the sentiment's pretty poor. I mean, we've established that, I think. And so setting up the bar for reality to clear is going to be pretty low. So, as challenging as we've seen this recent market environment, kind of hard to predict and stuff, the prevalence of pessimism is a reason, I think, to be bullish today. We're in a situation where the market's just pausing, I believe, to consolidate all these recent moves and wait for the next bullish catalyst to come out. It could be from the Fed heads or Mr. Powell or earnings. I'd probably vote for the earnings and then Mr. Powell in that order, but nonetheless, we'll see how it goes. So, in the S&P, they're supposedly collectively going to report for this quarter a 3.7 rise in earnings. Remember, earnings growth is how you make money in stock. The more they grow, the more you make over time. And so that's for the third quarter. That's the first increase in the last year. So, That looks pretty good. I think we can agree. And given that 81% of the S&P companies that have reported their earnings so far have beaten expectations, and that's more than average, and that the analyst forecast typically understate actual growth, once again, I think we're lowballing, and it's likelier than not that these folks have, again, underestimated as usual, which gives us the groundwork for a positive surprise. And that's the kind of surprises that help move stocks up that old wall of worry you hear about. Now, in the markets currently, technology, generally speaking, represents about 50% of the NASDAQ 100. Apple represents about 11% of it, and Microsoft about 10% of it. And by the way, yesterday, Microsoft traded to another all-time record high of about $369. And if you need some lunch money or something, they apparently could help you out because they've got a market value of $2.7 trillion right now. So you might just hit them up for a couple of dollars. Now, Charlie Bilello is a chartist of note. He says the combined revenue of the four largest U.S. companies, and right now those are Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, over the last 12 months hit a record $1.4 trillion in revenue. Now, try and get your head around this, because I have a hard time doing it. That number, $1.45 trillion, is larger than the GDP of all but 13 countries in the world. And, I mean, you know, you start talking about, oh, they're up or down a point or two. Come on. You know, look at the big picture. Look what these things are. A gentleman named Nicholas Colas, he's at Data Tech, kind of a tea leaf reading firm, and they say that there's only been 11 more up days than down days so far this year, and yet the S&P is up by around 14%. Well, how do you figure that? How can that be if the number of up days is about the same number of down days? You know, it isn't just a rally in big cap tech. Well, it has done that, but it isn't just that. Now, there were 8 days in the year so far that can explain the majority of the gains, and all of them related to what were then the biggest stories of the day or the year, whatever. The bad news is, of course, had you not been in the market on those 8 days, your returns would be considerably lower. So this reiterates, in my opinion, why market timing doesn't work. Nick is certainly, simply illustrating a problem that's been known to people forever. Market timing, that's the idea that you can predict the future direction of stock prices and then act accordingly, is not a successful investing strategy. Nick says that if you hadn't been in the market on those 8 days, your returns would have been very different. Also, if you don't own the big movers, so if in your portfolio, whatever it may consist of, if you don't have positions in those big names, you are going to not be having this 14% return. You will have something less, and more likely it'll be less because most folks have diversification, asset allocation, so they're not all just in the S&P as their investments. And we would recommend against that anyway, but be that as it may, that's about the only way it would work. Now, you know, this being in the market is not only true this year, it's been true every year, because if you put money into the market when prices are down and then sell when they're higher and buying when they're low again, that's the kind of closed loop. That's how you own stocks. The problem is that no one's consistently been able to identify market tops and bottoms. It's that timing thing, and the cost of not being in the market on the most important days can be devastating to a long-term portfolio, because you don't know when those days are going to come. So you don't know when to pull the trigger, do you? Because why is it so hard to do this? You have to be right twice. You have to be right going in and going out. Or if you're selling, going out and then going back in. The possibility you're able to make both and beat the market, I'd say that's infinitesimally low. You know, the key to investing isn't market timing. It's consistent investing and understanding your own risk tolerance, not what's in some magazine or on TV, but your own risk tolerance. You know, what's coming up now, what is in the offing, that is to say, is that firms are going to be coming out with their here's what we think is going to happen next year type reports. when I first started in a business, I said, oh, this is interesting. So I started collecting those and just making notes of them. Now I had, we didn't have computers, so I had big files of this stuff. And then a year later, you know, here comes another one. Let's see what they did. Holy Chihuahua. I don't recall any of them ever hitting it. I mean, it was all like, wow, you know, look at that. And sometimes they'd come in the neighborhood, but for the most part, you know, it's you read them and say, well, that's interesting. Those are interesting thoughts. And, you know, put them into your thinking process. But I wouldn't necessarily hang my retirement on one person's spin on the markets or another. It's just not right because, you know, and this is about any short-term forecast for the market. It is beyond difficult to predict with any remote accuracy where the market will be in a year. How about in a month? How about at the start of this week where you thought it would be at the end of next week? You know, and again, just as an aside, I did a little homework before we started this, and I looked back to a month ago, and basically the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ are all higher than they were a month ago. But I'll bet you wouldn't have thought of that just off the top of your head, given the way things have kind of been mishmashed around and certainly the way they've been reported. But it is a true thing. You may look it up to prove it yourself. So, anyhow, it's entirely difficult to predict what the market's going to do in the short term by anybody, anytime. Because in addition to all the variables to consider, there's also the totally unpredictable developments that occur along the way. You know, like that bug and other things that just kind of show up out of the blue. And strategists will often revise their market targets or stock price targets as new info comes in. But for most folks, it's probably not a good idea to overhaul your entire investment strategy simply based on the short-term market forecasts, much less the news or the headlines. Just don't, please don't do it. You know, Peter Lynch, the, how would I say, I don't even know, eminent investor. I don't know if anybody's done as good a job as him. Mr. Buffett's probably close, but in any regard. He said, the trick is not to learn to trust your gut feelings, but rather to discipline yourself to ignore them. Stand by your stocks as long as the fundamental story of the company hasn't changed. And just as a quasi-example of that, Mr. Buffett was traveling around with a gentleman, and the gentleman asked him, and this was in 2009, and the gentleman asked him, you know, the global economy was all messed up. And of course, as we know, the world was ending, but it didn't. But anyhow, and certainly, you know, Omaha, downtown Omaha, where Mr. Buffett hangs out, wasn't any exception. Stores closed, all that. So this gentleman says to Mr. B, he said, it's so bad right now. How does the economy ever bounce back from this? To which he cleverly responded, do you know what the best-selling candy bar was in 1962? The gentleman said, no. He said, do you know what the best-selling candy bar in 2009 is? No. And in both cases, it was Snickers. What does that prove? Not a lot, other than the value of the companies have little or nothing to do with what's going on in the markets per se. So don't be thinking of selling just because the price changed. I mean, if there's a fundamental reason, absolutely. I mean, if they're going into the buggy whip business and they've been making semi-chips all this time, yeah, you might want to consider getting out. But if there's just because of the economy and no real other challenges, that would be not a good idea. So, but this pessimism of disbelief persists. I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't understand it. It's not warranted. It seems like it's everywhere. You know, despite evidence that the U.S. economy has held up this year, there's always this search for the weak links and signs of a stumble to basically lead the headlines. You know, it's the good news is bad news spin. And so, as well, I have this designation called, what the heck's it called? Anyway, it's about doing, working with folks in their attitudes. There's a thing called cognitive dissonance, which means you have a hard time accepting competing ideas at the same time. You know, folks are, we all know, are adverse to discomfort. So what happens is that your brain works really hard to figure out a way you can get comfortable. You don't want to be uncomfortable, mentally or physically. You know, your inconsistent thoughts and beliefs make it hard to see both sides of an argument. I don't care what it is or who you are. You know, everything is seen as either good or bad with no middle ground, and so it is with the economy. Some people think the current economic environment stinks. Others think people are overlooking the positives. Well, as usual, the truth's probably somewhere in the middle. So let's kind of consider the good and the bad in the economy right now. And okay, economic growth is high. The economy is not getting enough credit, in my occasionally humble opinion, for taking on one of the most aggressive Fed hiking cycles ever, and then creating real GDP growth of almost 5%. You know, rates went from 0 to 5 in a big hurry, and yet the economy is still cooking along. You can make the case that a lot of this is, well, just a normalization process from the pandemic hit, but in the face of rising rates, it certainly was pretty much unexpected, considering most of the quote-unquote experts assumed we'd already be in a recession by now. Yeah, those guys have kind of gone, taken their course to the sidelines, haven't they? You know, this past quarter was probably the peak of the growth in this cycle, and yeah, it's possible recession's on the horizon, but we sure as heck aren't in one now. So, economic growth is good. Inflation's still relatively high, and consumers really hate inflation, it would appear. You know, the inflation rate was only this high once in the entire decade of the 2010s, and that was just for a mini second in the fall of 2011. That's why I think a lot of this is so hard for folks to swallow. They just haven't had to deal with it for a long time. And a lot of investors, especially in the 40s and, well, even 50s and below, this is all like, you know, minefield stuff. But please, believe me, we've been here before, and we've gone through this before and made it through before. You know, a lot of people didn't like the economic environment in the 2010s. Growth was slow, wages stagnated, interest rates were too low. But apparently folks hate high inflation more than they dislike that kind of environment, because wages have more or less kept pace with prices since the bug, but people get used to higher wages relatively quickly. You know, it's like, okay, I'm getting paid, that's nice, but higher prices beat you over the head every single day when you know, go to the store, buy something, whatever. You know, we're on the right path, I believe, but the inflation has experienced a rise in recent months, isn't helping with some folks' sentiment. So, volatile prices aren't good. Unemployment rate is low. The unemployment rate, such as it is right now, never got as low as it is today, even once in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. And that is a true deal. The employment recovery from the pandemic was an economic miracle, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, it cost the government trillions of dollars, but the alternative would have meant an economy that just, well, it was a few trillion dollars short, and there'd be millions of people unemployed. So, and more young and middle-aged folks have actually gotten jobs these past 3 years. You can check the job record. So low unemployment's a good thing. Yet the unemployment rate is rising. It went from it's still historically very low, but starting to rise up from a low of 3.4% nationally to 3.9%. Now, that trend isn't particularly good. You know, interest rates don't appear to be having a real adverse effect on consumers yet. Most consumers and corporations locked in those really low interest rates during the pandemic. And like guys like Apple, Microsoft, they took out a lot of debt at like totally, well, generationally low levels. And they're now earning high yields on all this cash they have. So that spread's working very well to their difference. And so if you're wondering one reason why the stock market's done so well in the face of rates, rising rates, that could be an explanation. And of course, as we know, if you've owned a house or refinanced before 2022, you're not fretting about higher mortgage rates right now, unless, of course, you have to move. And this is one of the main reasons consumers and corporations have been so resilient throughout the rise in interest rates. Now, on the other hand, interest rate sensitive industries are feeling the pain. Certain parts of the economy where higher rates are really kind of kicking the pins out from under them. You've seen it certainly in the utility industry. How about the mortgage lending industry? The Journal, Wall Street Journal, recently ran a story about the state of the business, and it's not pretty. The loan officers kind of went from the roaring 20s to a depression in like 3 years. You know, I don't see what it will take to make this better anytime soon, since rates would have to fall a lot to get activity back to those levels. So that's a tough place to be right now. And borrowers are being punished. If you locked in lower rates again, current environment doesn't seem so bad. But if you're a borrower, today's terms seem onerous when compared to the recent past. Again, operative term. When compared to the recent past, when compared to history, this is nothing. I know. But it's true. So it's just, please keep it in perspective. Mortgage rates now are above 7%. Car loan rates above 8%. And of course, you know, you got high prices, higher borrowing rates. That's a tough place to be for those who need to take on the debt. And housing prices are back at all-time highs. The Case-Shiller National Home Price Index back at all-time highs after a slight dip in price. And you don't have to go look for some exotic hedge against inflation. Owning a home was and still is probably your best defense against an inflationary spike. So lots of folks, Americans, own homes. So rising prices have been a benefit to folks' balance sheets. But again, good luck if you're on the outside looking in. We're still well below pre-pandemic levels of housing supply. Prices are up. It's expensive to borrow, and there aren't many houses in the market. You kind of get the idea. So those are the pros and cons of the market, the economy. And where you stand, as they say, is a function of where you sit. How you feel about the economy at any time depends upon how your personal economy is going. You know, I care personally about trying to determine the trend of the economy so I can pass that on to you folks. But individuals and households don't care about economic data. All people really care about is their personal situation. Now, there's a surprise. Their job, personal life, finances, family, all that. And there are good and bad things going on in the economy right now, but all people really care about is the good and bad things happening in their own lives. So nothing new under the sun. Now, finally, I want to talk a little bit about 60-40, because it's getting people talk about it like a redheaded stepchild. You know, it's just, oh, you can't do 60-40, it's terrible, you can't make any money, blah, blah, blah. Well, it was first the 60-40 split, which is 60% invested generally in stocks and 40% generally in bonds, was first proposed in 1952 by two guys, Harry Markowitz and William Sharp. They each received Nobel Prizes in economics for their work, so apparently somebody thought it was pretty good, as they developed what's called their modern portfolio theory. Now, okay, that's one thing. So that's how it started. Now, just by way of background, the bond market, U.S. bond market, has been in a drawdown for 39 months. That's the longest bond bear market in history. They're down 16% over the last 3 years. And they erased the gains of the previous 4 years. So basically, they've contributed nothing over the last 7 years, they meaning bonds. And last year was one of the worst years ever for 60-40 bond stock and bond mix. I think it was like the third worst year. The worst being 1931 and then 1937. So those were pretty tough times. So so that's, but it's just 1 year, okay? Bad years happen to every asset class and strategy. These things are called risk assets for a reason. But 1 year does not a successful strategy make or crack. You know, many in the financial media, have been pouring dirt all over the 60-40 because of a bad year in 22. It's broken. It's not going to work going forward. Correlations for stocks and bonds are higher when inflation was higher, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's a couple headlines from the past. In June of 2017, CNBC said the way Wall Street taught you to invest for the past 60 years may be dead. In 2015, kind of borrowed the headline, it looks like, 60-40 stock and bond portfolio is dead, according to USA Today. 2013, Business Insider had it that investors sticking to the 60-40 portfolio rule are likely to get badly hurt. Not a new idea, it would appear. But it's important to know that I'm not sure. I mean, really, I don't think I've ever met anyone who actually has had all their money split evenly 60-40. It's just like I've never seen the stock market get its average annual rate of return. But going back, most investors own some real estate. They hold some cash. They might be invested in some individual shares. And, of course, other strategies or asset classes. And we also live in a world, unfortunately, where pundits become famous for predicting the beginning or an end of something. So everything's got a top or a bottom, bull market, bear market. But I'll tell you what, you're never going to see the following headline. A boring diversified portfolio does well most of the time, but sometimes it doesn't. There's also a contingent of these so-called pundits who assume the 60-40 portfolio is a result of the disinflationary era from 80 to 21. The only reason they say returns were so high is because rates and inflation were falling. Well, that helped, yeah. But in the 41 years from 81 to 21, which saw rates and inflation mostly falling, the 60-40 returned 7.9%. In the 41 period year from 40 to 80, which saw rates and inflation rising, was 10.5%. Notice that rates were going up and a better return. So if you look for the previous 95 years, if you go back all the way to 1928 up to 2022, the annual return was 8.1%. So it's not like the environment for higher rates and inflation was that far away from a long-run average. So the crazy thing about this year being one of the worst year ever for 60-40 is that the 10 years ending last year were still pretty good. Annual returns, again, from 2013 to 22 were 7.7%. Now, your humble servant has no idea what the returns are going to be going forward because I don't have one of those crystal balls. I can't predict what the market or interest rates are going to do. But the 60-40 portfolio returns are in a pretty good place right now because investors can finally earn something on the 40. For example, if you were earning something in the 4-6% on your bond portion, the stock portion of a diversified portfolio doesn't have to do as much of the heavy lifting. You know, I think saying 60-40 is dead is like saying diversification is dead. That's a very short-sighted view that has no basis in reality, and I'll bet you $2 that the guy who's telling you it's dead has just the solution for you on the other side. Diversified portfolios are and remain alive. Thank you very much. So that's that's all I have for this week. Again, it was kind of a slow week. I hope that these comments have been helpful. And again, I don't exactly apologize, but I appreciate your forbearance in letting me have that little commercial at the beginning of the program. You know, the Zags are back, so it's time to get back on it and cheer the guys on the final victory. It's going to be interesting, I'm sure. So, thank you very much for listening. I hope that you have a great week and that we have some good things to pass on to you next week. This has been Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. My name is Mike Mayo, and again, I thank you very much for having listened.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.